loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows that the boat is leaking. Everybody knows the captain lied. Everybody got this broken feeling, like their father or their dog just died. Everybody talking to their pockets. Everybody wants a box of chocolates and a long stem rose. Everybody knows. Everybody knows that you love me, baby. Everybody knows that you really do. Everybody knows that you've been faithful, give or take a night or two. Everybody knows you've been discreet, but there were so many people just had to meet without your clothes. And everybody knows. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. That's how it goes. Everybody knows.
Once again on Radical Australia, International Day of People with Disability, the 3rd of December, yes, and also Eureka Day. Now, we have a special guest. We do have special guests every week, as all our listeners know, and we have Tricia Maloney. Good
Hello.
Afternoon, Tricia.
How are you?
I'm always good.
And me too.
Yeah, you look quite well.
I feel quite well. Yeah, I am very well.
You are very well. Yeah, but I'm a bit confused. Yeah. I got your name about 2 or 3 weeks ago and I've been trying to pronounce it ever since.
Yeah.
And so how do you spell Maloney?
M-A-L-O-W-N-E-Y, and it always causes confusion.
Excuse me?
Yes, we can't spell.
W in Maloney?
Yep. So
how did that come about?
Well, my husband's from Sri Lanka. His grandfather came from Ireland. And the story goes, this is one version of the story I've had, is that he had 2 children with without the W, and then had a disagreement with his brother, so stuck a W in the name so that he wouldn't be associated with him, had 2 children, then made up with his brother, took the W out and had 2 more children. So Noel and his brother are the only 2 who have the W in their name, and as Noel says, it's on his birth certificate, so he's keeping it.
That's confusing.
It is.
It is confusing. So what were you born? What was your name?
Name was Patricia Mary Josephine Haggerty.
Haggerty.
It's Northern Irish.
Northern Irish. You're one of those people, are you?
Yeah, well, I'm a combination of the North and the South.
So you're the perfect Irish person.
I am. My mother's family were Catholic. My dad's family were Protestant. And one of the stories is my dad reckons he met Mum while they're throwing stones at each other, but I don't think that's quite true.
Right.
But anyway, so Dad had to change his religion and his footy team before
Excuse
he
me?
Was allowed
Excuse
to marry
me?
Mum. Yeah, I know.
Excuse me. He the, changed his footy team
changed
to marry
footy.
Your mother.
Absolutely.
He must have loved her.
Still does. I mean, still does.
What, they're both still alive?
Absolutely.
How old are they?
Dad's 88, Mum's 84, and they're doing fine. So,
what do you mean they're doing fine?
Well, they're still out and about. I mean, you know, they've got the aches and pains and all the rest of it. And every so often we get called in to say goodbye to Dad, and then he's on a plane somewhere.
Oh, I thought you got called to say goodbye because he's dying.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. But and then he always, gets on a plane.
Yeah, but he always says it's just as well the hospital's over the road from the funeral parlour. We can right. just roll the trolley down the hill.
Right.
But then they've just got back from Broome, so they went by train to Sydney where they visited their latest great-grandchild.
Great-grandchild. How many grandkids have they got?
Good heavens, about 18, I think.
18 and great-grandkids?
I think we're up to 6 great-grandkids.
There is a term that was coined by the English for you, Mob. Fecund. F-E-C-U-N-D.
Yeah, well, it didn't come into this generation, let me tell you. So.
About how many? One of them, how many?
I'm one of ten.
One of ten.
Absolutely. And the only one who's had what we would now call a large family is the youngest, because she didn't have her share of nappies and late nights.
After anybody,
absolutely, And I can remember a story about my dad actually taking her into the kitchen when she was small to tell her that this wasn't a room you just walk through to get to the dining room, that things actually happened there. And he used to he told her the story about how I used to be tied to a chair so I could do the dishes.
You were tied to a chair. We'll come back to that later. Yeah. We'll come back to that later. You were actually tied to a chair. This sounds interesting.
It is.
How old were you when you were tied to a chair?
Oh, probably about three.
3 weeks. What's your earliest memory? Was this your earliest memory?
I know I've got earlier memories than that. I can remember sitting in the garden. We came from Yarraville originally.
Yeah.
And sitting in the garden and sucking the ends of honeysuckles to get the nectar out. So that's probably my earliest memory. So,
yeah, I used to do that too.
Yeah, it was good fun.
It was the only fun we used to have as kids in those days.
Well, we were pretty poor.
In the early, 10 kids.
Yeah, well.
So what number were you in the team?
I was number two.
Number two.
Yeah.
Number two.
Yeah, and it's funny because my mum was told to go when I got a disability. My parents were told to go away, put me in a home and go away and have more children.
Yeah, I don't.
All right.
I want to go back a step. I want to go back to this tying in the chair. This fascinates me. Now, look, I've heard about discipline, and in those days, in the early 50s, discipline was pretty tough. There was the strap, there was the cane, there was the smack across the chops, but you were tied in a chair. Now, why would your parents tie you in a chair at three? What horrible thing did you do?
Well, it wasn't that it was horrible. It was because I wanted to do the dishes, and I wanted to do it by myself, and if they didn't tie me on a chair, I would fall off.
You would fall off.
Yeah. So that was, it wasn't discipline.
So they tied you on the chair so you could do the dishes.
Yeah, because I wanted to.
You don't think that's discipline?
No, because I wanted to.
You wanted to.
I wanted to be the same as everybody else.
Well, a lot of people say this about sadomasochistic relationships.
Absolutely.
And the masochist wants to.
I wanted to do the dishes. As all little kids do, they want to help around the house.
No, not in 2014.
After three, they don't.
No.
But at three, they do.
So what was life like in Yarraville?
Lovely.
What do you mean lovely?
Well, I grew up in a very warm community. So we lived in Yarraville, a little dead-end street. Mm-hmm. My grandmother lived five doors down, and everybody in the street knew everybody else. So I was welcome in everybody's home. Mm. We used to have parties, like birthday parties. Everybody in the street would come. Mm. It was a safe environment, absolutely.
So did you go to the primary school there?
I went to the Catholic school, naturally.
Yes.
So we went to St. Augustine's.
How old were you then?
Started school there at 4.5.
4.5, that was a bit early.
Pretty smart kid, hey? Yeah. No. So I started school there and my older brother went to the same school.
Right.
And then we moved.
You moved?
Yeah, we moved. And we moved to Mitcham.
Mitcham.
Yeah, and people thought Mum and Dad were mad taking us so far out in the bush.
That's right. There's all the orchards out
there. Absolutely. Unmade roads.
End of the world.
Absolutely.
End of the known universe. So how old were you when you moved to Mitcham?
So we were six.
You were six.
And
what was school like at Yarraville?
Yarraville, I don't have much memory of school.
And how about Mitcham?
Mitcham was interesting, very interesting.
Why was it interesting?
Because I was just one of the other students, but it was interesting.
What do you mean you were just one of the other students? Well, I mean, why shouldn't you be one of the other students?
Because in those days, if you had a disability, you were segregated.
Hang on. Disability?
Yeah, I had
When did all this happen?
Okay, I got polio at the age of 4 months.
In 54?
In 54.
So this must have been the last wave of the polio epidemic, was it?
I'm one of the youngest Australian-born polio, so
you
something
got polio
a banner.
Polio at 4 months.
Yep.
Well, maybe that's why you were tied to the chair.
Absolutely.
Maybe you had problem with your balance or something.
Absolutely.
So how did it affect you as a little girl?
Okay. I wore calipers. So I didn't walk till I was about three, but I wore calipers until I was 16. Mm. I wore orthopedic shoes. Mm. But generally I did mostly what other people did. Mm.
Did you have any issues with your breathing?
Not then.
Not then, not at that stage
no.
when you're a young person.
Now I do, but not then.
Not then.
Yeah.
And did you have any other issues with your bladder or bowel?
No, I was really lucky. I always consider that I was one of the lucky people who had polio because I got it at such an early age. I don't have any negative memories of the segregation or the ostracising of people who had polio. So my mother has told me stories about people crossing the street when they saw
because
us coming.
It was quite horrendous in that period because one minute you've got a normal child and the next minute you've got a child with a major disability who's going to die.
Absolutely.
And people didn't really know what to do.
And there was a lot of fear. We call it the AIDS of the time. Mm. So people were fearful that their child would be affected and they were fearful that by associating with somebody who had a child with polio, they would be affected.
Mm.
So the vaccination came out in 56, of course, and then there was no longer this great panic for people.
Mm-hmm.
But I often think, like, I wasn't affected emotionally because I didn't have the negativity.
Mm.
It was certainly accepted by my community and by my family, and so I was just another child.
Right.
And I've talked to Mum about this, and she says there wasn't any time for any princesses.
Right.
And she was actually, she's fairly radical. She doesn't see herself as radical. Mm. But when we moved to Mitcham, it was a new suburb, so there wasn't much room in the schools. And so in those days you had to front up to the Catholic priest to get a place in the school, and she fronts up and she said, I want to enrol my children. He said, there's no room. She said, is that because my child has a disability? He said, I just found two places.
Right.
So she was front up straight away. Right. You are going to get access to everything you need.
Mm.
And can I tell you that as a working class family, they had to beg, borrow, and I don't think they stole, to get the equipment that I needed.
So what type of equipment did you need as a small child?
Well, as a small child, I had to have what they called a polio pram.
What's a polio pram?
It's a huge pram that would fit my double Thomas splint. So as a young baby, I was in a double Thomas splint.
Right. Explain what a double Thomas splint is. Because it is, I think it would do really well in a dungeon.
Absolutely.
Tell us about it.
If you think of a piece of board that has a crucifix-like appearance. So my legs were strapped into the board and my arms were strapped outstretched on the board for some period.
Yes.
That was what I went to bed on.
Yes.
So that was very interesting. And the polio pram was big enough to be able to accommodate that.
And so what was the polio pram?
Polio pram was just an ordinary pram that was huge.
Huge.
Yeah.
Could you fit it on a tram?
I couldn't get anything on a tram in those days. No. I still can't get on a tram.
So could you? So how did your parents get you around in Mitcham?
Just train we could manage.
Right.
But they pushed us everywhere. We didn't have a car back then. You know, nobody had cars in those days. So they just pushed me in the pram and I went to absolutely everything.
Mm-hmm.
One of my earliest memories of that time is I could walk a little bit once I got calipers.
Right.
And I like.
So how old were you when you got calipers?
Well, I started to walk at three. I probably had the calipers a bit earlier.
A bit earlier,
but
right.
I was certainly would be carried places where I wanted to walk. And if I don't know if you know Yarraville, there used to be an underpass under the railway line.
Yes.
My favourite thing to do would be to walk down there.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandmother told me that people would pick me up and carry me down. And
right.
I would get quite cross because I wanted to do it myself.
So certainly
I was very determined.
Right.
But I think that comes from my parents' expectations of me that I would achieve.
So you don't think you were treated any different to the other children?
I think I was.
How were you treated differently?
I got to go swimming on Wednesdays.
You got to go swimming in the late 50s. That's it.
Yeah,
where's
absolutely.
The pool in Mitcham?
This was back in Yarraville.
I used
to go to the city baths.
The city baths.
And on the way back, Mum used to buy me a potato cake at Flinders Street Station.
Wow.
And
you were
I don't think anybody else in the family got that.
Would have got a potato cake at Flinders Street Station and city baths. That's still there, you know.
I know. It's sort of like all those years ago and I can still smell it, you know, the chlorine in it. So that was my special treatment.
Special treatment.
Yeah, that was
you
my
were
special.
Tied to a chair and you were drowned. You were crucified.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah, so
I like this. This is an interesting interview.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? So, but, you know, sort of one of my sisters tells the story that she was at school and somebody came up to her and said, what's wrong with your sister? And she said, what do you mean? What's wrong with your sister? And she said, well, what's wrong with her legs? And Kath went, what do you mean?
Right.
She had no idea. So she went home and asked Mum, who, you know, said, oh, well, your sister's have polio. And she went, oh, has she? Because it just wasn't an issue.
In the house.
Yeah. No. And in fact, as yes,
that's Trish.
Yeah, exactly. And it's really interesting because I've had this conversation with people I went to school with. Did you see me as the person with a disability? And they said, no, we never even thought about it. It was just always, I went to the same school as everybody else.
So in the primary school, what was it? Was it Mitcham Primary School?
Yep, that was St. John's.
St. John's.
St. John's.
In Mitcham. Now, how did you get from class to class?
I walked. It was
with your calipers.
With my calipers. Right. I never even thought that I wouldn't be able to do it.
Right.
And
how much effort did that take?
Back then, I didn't even think of it.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have a car. It's interesting, you know, you think back on these things. When we were going out, I would leave the house an hour or half an hour before everybody else so that we could make sure we caught the train on time.
Right.
And we didn't think of that. We just did it. Mm-hmm. Or if it was going to be a long trip, I would sit on the front of a double pusher because Mum always had babies, so there was always babies. And my older brother would push that. And Mum doesn't know. He used to let go of it at the top of hills.
Right.
But that's all right.
You know, well, he was an older brother.
Absolutely.
That's his duty to let it go and frighten his sisters.
Absolutely. But can I tell you, too, that the older brother thing, too, was that I never got picked on at school. And I suspect now that it was because I had an older brother.
Yes.
Who would not have allowed it.
Right.
The other thing that was really interesting is that we got older, we caught the bus to school. So we were a mile from the station.
Right.
So we would catch the bus to school and the bus home. On the way home, the bus driver would drop my family off at the end of the street and would drive around and drop me off at home.
Right.
And then keep on the route. You know, it was sort of, and I met him years later and he said, do you remember I used to do that? And I said, I absolutely do. You know, it was those little things that people would do.
So people were accommodating.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah. And I think
you must have been a bright, bubbly little person, I reckon.
I think that's a family trait as well. Mm. I think that, so I didn't know that I had a disability. I just thought that was me. And so I don't think it was the oppression that it was on others.
Any teachers in primary school that you remember?
Yeah, I remember Sister Leonard, who was pretty tough. We had some tough nuns where I went to school, and the discipline. We talk about discipline. You think now they'd be in jail. You know, some of them were fairly tough. I can remember there was Sister. I can't remember her name, but she was a novice, and one person spoke in the room and didn't own up to it. So they brought all three grade two classes. So these are little kids.
Yes,
and we all got the strap.
All of it.
Yeah. So
I love it. Collective punishment, crucifixion.
I know. And there were 60 in a class in those days.
Yeah.
You know, sort of. And the expectations of me were, I think, quite high.
Right.
I don't think that I was allowed to sit down and go, oh, you've got a disability, you don't have to do that. It was, if you've got a disability, you're going to have to prove yourself.
Were you able to participate in any sporting type of things?
Sport. I did play netball. I could play centre, and I had a go at tennis,
right.
But I can only do backhand, and the guy who was teaching me said, I think I'll give that up.
Right.
Because I always hit it over the fence, and he had to get it. And we played backyard cricket, and whenever I went out, my dad would always say, I'll give her another go. So, you know, my family sort of jacked up on that and said, excuse me.
Well, it's 10 of you. Everybody absolutely needs
to believe that. Yeah. And then my other sport, I come from a family of runners, and my dad was a shunter in the railways.
Right.
So real working class. And we used to go to the shunter's picnic, and there was races, so there was always races. And the handicappers were the people who worked with my dad.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would be put 3 foot from the winning line, you know. So all I had to do was fall over and I'd win. Yeah. And my dad would never, ever let me accept the prize.
Right.
Never, ever. He would say, no, there are people there who are competing and they deserve the win. Just because you're there and just fall over, it doesn't give you the prize. And so then all the drunk shunters would give me 10 bob each.
Yeah.
And my dad would never let me keep that either.
No, he did.
He used to say to me, though, you know, you have to compete in the real world.
Yeah.
it's no point getting things for nothing now. You have to be able to stand up in the real world.
Did you go to high school?
Yeah, went to Mater Christi Ladies College in Belgrave. Yes.
In Belgrave.
As you can see, I'm
Belgrave.
Such a lady. Yes.
Belgrave.
Which was where people went for their holidays.
Yeah, but how did you get from
Mitcham
to Belgrave?
We caught the train. Everybody I went to primary school with, except the rich kids. So we had a choice. It was the closest, cheapest Catholic secondary college.
Right.
There was one closer in Box Hill, but that was a little bit expensive.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of my family went to Aquinas in Ringwood.
Right.
And people say, well, is that because you had a disability? And it's no, because I was too old to go to Aquinas. They didn't build the girls' part until after I started secondary college.
Right. What was secondary college like at Belgrave?
It was good. It was really good. I lost a year
a year. How did you do that? Did you fall asleep or
something? Well, I feel like I should have. I was in hospital down at Mount Eliza for
Why were you in hospital?
I had surgery on my knee, and in those days it was 6 months in plaster from the waist down, so I couldn't stand up.
And how old were you?
16.
15.
Yeah. So I missed the year. I only went back to school for the scholarship. That was the scholarship year. It was in year 10.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say form four in my day. Yeah. And so I didn't get the scholarship because I hadn't been at school all year. But it was really funny because I couldn't wear a uniform.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't fit it over all the plaster and everything.
Right.
And one of the nuns
told me off. You were wandering around the place in the plaster.
Yeah.
A hip spiker.
No, it was from the waist down.
Explain to people exactly what it meant.
What it meant was that I could only stand up or lay down. I couldn't sit down for a year.
How did you go to the toilet?
I had to be taught to lay across the toilet before I was allowed to come home from hospital because,
you lay across the toilet. And how long did this go on for?
6 months.
6 months.
And my parents are very interesting people. In order for me to participate, they bought a station wagon because we had a car by then.
Right.
And they traded their old car in, bought a station wagon and used to slide me in the back of the station wagon like a pizza and the rest of the family would sit cross-legged around me. We couldn't do it today. But in those days.
That's how you got around.
And they did that. They made a conscious decision to do that.
Was it worth all the effort once the plaster was removed?
Well, I gained an inch in height.
Right.
So I'm now 4'9" So I think every inch counts.
You got an inch.
Yeah, and my knee had been bent all that time. But that was the only surgery I'd had. So that was a year where I thought it was a bit mean that I got told off for not being in uniform.
I'd tell you off for lying across the toilet. I wouldn't care about the uniform.
Yeah, exactly. And I had to stand up to do the exam.
You stood up for the exam.
Yeah.
So how did all that go? When did you finish high school?
I finished at the end of year 11.
Right.
And I did all the commercial subjects in those days. I wanted to teach, but they told me I couldn't. Because I had a disability and you couldn't have a person with a disability teaching.
Mm-hmm.
So I did the commercial subjects and the only subject I've ever failed is shorthand and typing.
And you did the commercial
subjects? I did the commercial.
So once you left grade 11, you would have been a great employment prospect if you failed shorthand and typing.
Absolutely. So
what happened? Where did you go to work?
I went to work in the State Savings Bank of Victoria.
Right, yes.
And my dad went in and said, give my daughter a job.
Right.
Which is a lot of my parents were both pretty pushy and they said, all right, we'll give her a go. So I got a job in the State Savings Bank.
What were you doing?
Well, I wasn't allowed to be a teller in those days because I was a girl.
And you were too short.
Well, probably.
You wouldn't be able to look over the legs in those days.
Same height sitting and standing. So I was allowed to do the ledger operation and I was allowed to make the tea and I was allowed to do the post.
Now, did you make the tea in a teapot? Obviously, you didn't
have
tea bags.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Have you got any hints for the listeners of how to make a good cup of tea?
Absolutely. Definitely. One for each person, one for the pot. Take the pot to the hot water, not the hot water to the pot. And when you finish, turn the pot three times.
See, I knew you'd be a fund of knowledge. I mean,
absolutely.
If you were paid money to make tea, you'd have to do it properly. Because did you give biscuits with the tea to the other tellers?
No. But I was allowed. I did go to the shops and buy their morning tea and their lunches. So I was allowed to do that.
So what suburb was this? Can you tell us?
Yeah, I started off working in Box Hill.
And then where?
And then I went to, where was that? In Mitcham. I moved to a branch. And that was good because what I used to do was, because it was such a small manual branch, I used to take the rest of my family to school on the way.
Right.
And then pick them up on the way back.
So you were driving.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That was the first thing I did when I turned 18, was get my license. So
how did they handle this young woman in calipers when you went to get your license?
Well, after I'd had that surgery, they told me I didn't need calipers anymore, which was wrong, but anyway. My parents bought an automatic when I needed to learn to drive, so I learned to drive in an automatic. My right leg isn't affected. However, after I passed my driving test, I still had to wait 6 months till they got medical opinions as to whether my polio would affect my driving. So, but once I got my license, oh my God, you couldn't stop me. Mm. And don't forget, this is back in the days before there were speed limits.
Yes, yes.
Or drink driving laws. Oh dear.
Don't want to know about that. We don't want to know about that one. I mean, you can keep your drug and alcohol taking to yourself.
Absolutely.
This is a respectable family afternoon program.
Well, there
could
go.
Be kiddies listening, and we wouldn't want them to get the wrong opinion on the International Day of Disability.
I can tell them the rule for that is don't.
Don't, right. Yeah. So how long did you last at the State Bank for?
I was there for 4 years.
4 years. And then where?
I came home one day for Mum to have a discussion with me that she thought I needed to broaden my horizons.
And what, you were about 20 then? Or?
Yeah, I was 20. Yep. So next thing you knew, I was working in an Indigenous community in the Northern Territory as a radio operator.
Excuse me. 74, during the Whitlam period.
Mm-hmm.
Here we go. Young girl in the bank. And then bang, where in the Northern Territory?
I was working in a place called Port Keith, which is now called Wadi.
Right, Wadi.
Yeah, which is...
How did you get there?
Plane. And then I got
off. How did you get the job, I mean?
Well, it was advertised in the Catholic newspaper.
Right.
So I wrote away. Next thing you knew, I was there. I think I might have been the only applicant.
Right.
So I ran the... I was the radio operator and I ran the post office and I counted the church takings and generally
so
did
was
anything.
What was Wadi like in 74?
I loved it.
Tell us what it was like physically.
Well, there wasn't any cars that I could drive, so I had a car and a driver eventually because we tried all sorts of things to get me around. So truck and a driver, but it was a place where I didn't fit in very well because I was working for the Catholic Church, and I didn't like the way they treated Aboriginal people.
So how? What didn't you like?
I didn't like that they thought that they were children.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like that they thought they were unintelligent. I didn't like that they were paternalistic and patronising. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in the Catholic Church, and the priests that I knew were empowering. Mm. And these were people who saw Indigenous people as the other. Mm. And so the house that I lived in, I lived with three school teachers. We all got the sack. Yay!
What do you mean you got the sack?
They asked us please to leave.
How long did you last?
A year.
Yeah, you were asked to leave.
Yeah.
Well, you just didn't fit in. You're asking too many questions. Is that
yes, we questioned their behaviour. People could get jobs if they said they were Catholic.
Right.
So everybody was Catholic. But in reality, they weren't.
Right.
They had their own religion, but it wasn't acknowledged. And I didn't appreciate that this wasn't even seen. And I must admit...
Did this actually affect your faith?
Oh, I did. What faith? I don't have a faith.
But
I'm an atheist.
At that stage, when did you become an atheist? How old were you when you were an atheist?
I suppose I acknowledged it when I was about 25, but I think
after
the journey.
After
I know I was a
good
Catholic.
That's what I'm saying.
Girl.
Was this a pivotal moment?
Absolutely. It was the start of the journey to atheism.
Right.
And I don't call myself an agnostic. I actually call myself an atheist. I'm really happy for other people to have their
faith. Welcome to the club. If you're talking to a fellow atheist here on Radical Australia.
There's a few of us around.
Yeah, there is a lot. This is Radical Australia on Community Radio 3CR 855 on your AM dial on International Day of People with Disability. And I'm talking to Tricia Maloney with a W.
That's me.
So what happens after you leave there? Where do you go?
Well, I didn't know what to do, so I actually came back to Melbourne and they were really funny because they gave me two letters, one to say, please don't come back, and one that I could show my mum saying, thanks for being here. So they were sort of, it was really sort of dichotomy there.
Yeah.
I came back to Melbourne and I got a job in a factory, Gordon and Gotch.
Yep.
Packing
yep.
books.
Yep.
And I was fairly innocent back then, and the guys used to show me dirty pictures as a way, because I always went, oh, right. You know, they got a reaction, so they did it. And I didn't. It was also part of my journey to acknowledging my feminism.
Was this a bit of penthouse, was it?
Or
a bit,
oh,
a bit
no, more, it was much extreme. Worse than penthouse. Worse, it was the real deal. Yeah. Yeah, penthouse. It's
the usual,
you know,
factory shit. Absolutely. In the late '70s. Yeah.
Absolutely. So I lasted there a year, and the reason I went there is because I didn't really want to go back to ordinary office work.
Right.
So I worked there for a year. Here am I, the person with a disability who couldn't teach because you couldn't stand up, and all the jobs I'd had would involve standing up. So I wanted to go overseas. Now, everybody else was going to England and Europe, so I went to America, as you do, because I'm just one of those people who just doesn't go with the flow. So I went to the US.
How long were you there for?
5 months.
Anything stand out about the trip?
Well, I was mugged. That was
mugged?
Good. Yeah, I was mugged in New Orleans.
What happened?
I was backpacking, so it was fairly easy just to knock my legs out from under me.
Right.
So my ticket and passport and money was stolen, and a guy came to my aid and got my ticket and my passport and my money back for me, which
really?
Was really good.
How
yeah.
did you do that?
He just came up and pulled the gun out. It's fairly easy. Told the guy to give it back to me.
Yes.
And,
that's,
as you do. You know,
as you do in New Orleans. Yeah,
so that was fairly interesting. And he then, because I was really tired, it was the end of the trip, and he then took me in and took me to a family to help me recover a bit.
Right.
He was an African-American, and we got spat on the street because...
Together.
Absolutely, you know, and you sort of think, oh, come on, get over yourself.
Yeah.
And he was really amazed when I said, you know, he said, oh, I'd like to come to Australia, but I know I couldn't because your family... my family couldn't care less.
Yeah.
You know, you can't come... And he was amazed by that.
Yeah.
But he worked in the Famous Door nightclub. He was a piano player.
Right.
So, you know, it was just an interesting
experience. No wonder he carried a gun, just in case they didn't like his music.
Well, that's right. But it's like...
That's the way it should be if you're a musician.
They did offer me a job in a topless nightclub.
Ooh.
Yeah, but not taking my top off, just to take the money.
Because, oh, just take the money.
Yeah,
right.
So, but they sort
of, that must have been a put down.
No, it was fine. I was fairly young still, you know, sort of. I was 23, and still fairly innocent in the worldly terms. Otherwise, I wouldn't have travelled alone in America. I mean, Mum had a cousin there, and I used to go and spend time with her. On and off, you know, so I'd go back for 2 weeks and come back and all the rest of it. And every time they come back, they'd say, thank God you're back. We've just heard of a woman who was killed here or a woman who was killed there. Used to say, hey, listen, wait for them to say she had one leg shorter than the other.
Right.
Then you'd know it was me. Right. Yeah. So, but Mum encouraged me to do that.
Right.
You know? So,
and in those days, there was no internet. You hardly ever rang home because it was so expensive.
Absolutely.
You just did your thing. And if your parents were lucky, they got a letter once a year.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And because when I was in Port Keats, the only means of communication was by telegram or letter.
Yep.
So, you know, that was it.
Port Keats.
That was back in the Indigenous community.
Excuse me. Hang on. So you come back from the States, you get mugged, somebody saves you, you get spat on in the streets, you come back, and what did you do next?
Then I thought perhaps I'd better get a job, so I joined the railways.
Yeah.
So I applied for a job on a train as a waitress. And, of course, I didn't get the job.
No.
Because who wants hot water down their neck? And so my dad went back to work and he said to his mates, because by then he was the assistant yardmaster, but he worked with shunters and they all knew me. And he said, oh, Tricia didn't get the job. And they said, well, we're going on strike then.
Excellent. What year was this?
Oh, what was that? 88, 89, something like that.
89, right.
No, sorry, 78,
70. So did they go on strike?
No, they didn't, because the railways went all over to find her a job.
So where did they find you?
They found me a job as a clerical assistant down at the Spotswood General Storehouse.
Ah, near Yarraville again.
Yeah, back down there. And Grandma was still in Yarraville, so I moved in with her for a while. But... that's another reason for my activism, because when I get down there, of course, I couldn't become a clerk because I was a female.
Mm-hmm.
And this is in the late 70s still. Yep. So I got the job and I thought, oh, bloody hell, I'm only staying here long enough to save up to go overseas.
Mm-hmm.
And then I met Noel.
Noel?
That's my
Who's
husband.
Noel?
He's my husband.
You met Noel.
I met Noel. And
love.
Instantaneous.
Where was this?
This
was an office romance, was it?
No, it wasn't. Well, sort of, no. Well, he.
You don't have to tell us everything.
No, his best of year. Anyway, so Noel's brother was married to the friend of a friend of mine. So she invited us down on the same day, and next thing you knew, we were getting married. But
how long was this courtship?
Well, it was ended up being longer than we wanted, but
which was what?
18 months or so.
Why did it take 18 months?
Because he was here on a holiday and on a visitor's visa from Ireland.
An illegal immigrant, eh?
Yeah, that's one right. Didn't come on a boat, though. It came on a plane. That's
it came different. On a plane. Yeah, right, okay. Yeah. Well, he's acceptable then.
Yeah, but he came on a visitor's visa.
Yeah.
And so I sponsored him out here. Right. So it was, I think it was about 18 months before we saw each other because he had to go back to Ireland.
Yes,
and that was
right.
fine. But the day we met was really quite funny because when his sister-in-law, Cisco, was bringing him to see us, the car broke down and they pulled into a service station where my dad was working part-time because my dad always had two jobs.
Right.
So that was sort of do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. And then when we get down there, I worked out Cisco used to live behind us when we were kids when she first came out from Finland.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like it was almost like we were destined to meet.
It was destined, yeah. So where was the wedding?
The wedding was at the last wedding at St. John's in Mitcham.
Why the last wedding?
Well, because they pulled it down and built
a new
one.
But after you were married, it wasn't good enough.
It was an old Nissen hut.
Oh,
it was the old church in Mitcham.
Right.
So we were the last
wedding.
So
you still had a church wedding?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Did you have all the extras? The bridesmaids, the
God,
long
yes.
train,
well,
the fudge-up photographer,
absolutely.
The car.
Yep, well, Dad's mate's car.
Yeah.
And the reception was at Mum and Dad's place.
Oh, right.
And
yep.
Mum's friends did the cooking and Dad's friends were the barman.
Right.
And it was still going two days
later.
You
didn't have a honeymoon in the CBD in Melbourne, did
no,
you?
No, we went to King's Cross for our honeymoon.
Oh, right.
Because we didn't have any money.
Right, that's what
it cost all cost us all our money to get out here. So by the time we got married, we had $50 between us.
Right.
Our furniture was two beanbags that somebody lent us. My sister lent us a bed. Somebody else lent us a fridge. Our wedding presents were, we asked for things like tea towels, towels, and, you know, there was none of the electrical goods that you get. We had a black and white TV that Mum and Dad lent us. So we whatever we've got, we've built together.
Right.
We've been really
so
lucky.
So how long have you been married now?
Nearly 35 years.
Any children?
No. We spent 20 years on IVF and all we ended up with was broke.
Right. It's very hard.
But that's okay. We both come from large families, so there's lots of kids around and we have my sisters have offered to lend us children from time to time.
I'm sure the good thing is you can always give them back.
Absolutely,
that's the beauty about that.
So that's a period of mourning.
It is. So what type of work was your husband doing?
He worked for the railways in the end, so he was a timetable planner.
Right.
So he started off working on the stations, and worked his way up to be a timetable planner.
Right. So this Port Keats business, when did this all happen?
That was in the, so 74, 75 was Port Keats.
So before you got married.
Oh, yeah, before, that sort of changed all of my plans for the future, which didn't include marriage, which didn't include settling down, which included more of the travel around the world sort of
thing. So you didn't actually, when you were a young woman, marriage wasn't something you consciously thought about?
When I was a very young, not as a young woman, but as a young girl, certainly. Yeah. I was going to be my mum.
Yep.
So I was going to have, actually, I thought about 16 children would be about right.
Right, yeah.
But, sort of, fortunately, that didn't happen.
Almost an AFL team.
Well, mum and dad had a netball team.
Exactly, yeah.
But, you sort of think, what you think when you're 9 and 10 is very different to what you think when you're an adult.
Right.
And, one would have been nice. I would have liked to see what it looked like before I had another one. But, sort of it's not been – and sometimes you sort of think what happens to you is how you end up. And so everything is a positive.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't be the person I am if I had have taken those other pathways.
Now, had the polio manifested itself in any way before you were married?
Oh, yeah. I had a limp back then. So that was it.
Yeah, and what happened next?
So I decided to go back to uni, right? So because I couldn't become a clerk in the railways because my education standard wasn't high enough, I went back to uni and they said, well, you still can't become a clerk because you still don't have HSC. So I told them they were stupid because I can get into uni, but I couldn't become a clerk. And then I moved to police.
Right.
I got a job as a research officer with police, and that was, I think, working for Victoria Police was the best job I've ever had.
How many years were you with Victoria Police?
10 years.
So it's that all during the 80s?
No, that was the 90s.
And what did you actually do?
Research officer for a start. So I worked on things like analysing public submissions. So we had a public submission on how to reduce crime, and we got things like arm all police with submachine guns. The usual. And no, I don't think that's stuff. Well, they'll never do it again.
No, they'll never do it again. They'll never ask the public.
Yeah, that's right. So we'll just eliminate
public
everybody.
Public executions and all that type of stuff. Yeah, yeah.
But then they
the IS model.
Absolutely. Yeah. Public beheadings. So then they asked me, would I be their disability liaison officer?
And my disability liaison officer in Victoria. Who was the chief commissioner who thought of this?
It was Neil Comrie, but the person who thought of it was an outstanding woman called Sandy Langlands, who was the inspector of the Equal Opportunity Unit. And she said to me, would you do that? And I said, well, actually, I don't know anything about it. I didn't know anything about the disability sector
at all. This was in the 90s.
Yeah, so... Mm-hmm. And it would have been about 93, 94. So I said, well, okay, let me have a look at it. So I went and moved over to her unit. And I thought, oh, I should be entitled to that. Oh, hang on. I didn't know about that. But I was working with internal employees. And it was at the time that Kennett came in. And when he came in, one of the first things he did was decimate the public service. And the first people who go in the public service are people with disabilities. So Neil Comrie was the chief commissioner, and he asked, would I find positions for all the staff with disabilities? Because they brought in multi-skilling, and those who had intellectual disabilities would not be able to do multi-skillings. So I found a position for all of them, so that was really good. And then we thought, well, you know, what we should be doing is for any unsworn position, that is those who wouldn't be catching crooks, we make them people with disabilities. So they actually had a program back then. Now, Victoria Police can do it. Anybody can do it.
Can do it. Well, yeah, it's considering all the paperwork and meetings and stuff you got to go through to get anything done.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it was sort of, it was a really positive step. I don't know if that's still going on. But, yeah, so, and then they asked me to travel. I travelled the state talking to people about equity issues, I suppose. And I also made sure that every police station was made accessible. And I used to, when I used to talk to police, I used to ask them,
why do you want to make police station accessible? People with disabilities need police?
Absolutely.
Why is that?
Well, they might. You know, well, I actually used to say to police, how does a person with a disability get into a police station? And there was always blank looks. Yeah. And so I'd say to them, well, you throw a stone and break a window, they'll soon make sure you get in.
Right.
But that was only part of it, and the bigger part of it that's still going on now is how do people access justice more than police stations?
Justice.
Absolutely. So it's about...
Why do you want to access justice?
Well, because people with disabilities experience crime at much higher rates than anybody else.
What do you mean experience? Aren't we all nice to you?
No, well, see, that's the assumption. So we in the family violence, which I work a lot in the family violence sector now, if somebody stays with a person with a disability, they must be a really good bloke. And my husband gets that a bit. So Noel gets that. People say, oh, you're a good bloke. And he thinks, yes, because I am a pain to live with, but it's got nothing to do with my disability.
Right.
Yeah, just a pain generally. But it's about people who are predators, who are looking for somebody vulnerable. And so the types of things that affect women with disabilities, for example, are people will put their wheelchair just out of reach, right? Or they'll take away their mobile phone, which is their only communication method. Or they abuse them financially. And then there's the verbal abuse, which affects all women, but particularly women with disabilities. You're worthless, you know, look at you. Everybody knows that I'm a good bloke because I'm staying with you and look at you. My husband hates the term carer, which he gets a lot. He prefers to call himself my husband or my partner.
Well, he's not your carer.
But this is the way society...
Yeah, but he's not your carer. I mean, people get paid to care.
Exactly.
You know, even
well, they're not paid to care. They're actually paid to be support workers. But we've got a society who's decided that people with disabilities are burdens and that we need carers, that we're not independent. And with the appropriate supports, people can be independent.
So what type of support are you talking about?
Well, all sorts of things. So it might be that people might need help to shower, right? But that's not caring. That's support. They might need some help to communicate. It's not caring. It's support. They might need help to get transport. That's not caring. That's support. And I think we've got this language. So at the moment, we've got a government that calls us leaners, not lifters.
Mm.
We were actually.
You realise, you know who the government's talking about?
Yeah, me.
No, they're talking about corporate Australia.
Because they
don't pay tax.
I pay more tax than most corporate.
That's right. You actually pay more tax than Apple and Google combined.
Absolutely.
And you pay more tax than Mr. Murdoch because he got an $882 million tax refund
and
last
he
year.
He has clearly said that there's nothing wrong about that, but he's not talking about moral wrong.
No. The thing is, this is it. See, this is it. You have been targeted.
Absolutely.
As a group.
Absolutely.
You're part of a whole wedge of Australians. You've been wedged. It's the disability, the poor, the working poor. It goes on and on. And when you look at the facts and the figures,
absolutely,
you are not the leaners. The leaners is corporate Australia.
I know.
They pay less than 15% of the tax take of the whole country. News Corporation got almost $1 billion refund last year. 21st Century Fox, the other arm of the company, 1% tax. It's just extraordinary. And we've got these mugs that call people who are paying their taxes like yourself, who may have a physical or intellectual or emotional issues, leaners.
Absolutely.
Well, they're the leaners.
Well, at the moment, I'm on a small disability support pension.
Oh, you're a leaner.
Yeah, I know. And I do that because nobody pays me for the work I do. So I work virtually full time.
Yes.
I had to give up
work. So what type of work are you doing?
Advocacy.
What's the funny word? What does it mean?
Okay, for me, it's about going and making sure the voice of the disadvantaged is heard.
Mm.
So people with disabilities are often unheard. So where are the jobs for people with disabilities? So I go and talk to the corporate sector and say, you know, people with disabilities need work. Where are you stepping up to the plate? I talk to the public sector. Oh, my God. The public service have, I think it's 3.6 of the public service are people with disabilities. We're 20% of the population.
Mm.
And I've just been awarded an Ethel Tembe research grant to travel to Ireland to have a look at the National Disability Strategy.
Who was Ethel Tembe?
Ethel Tembe was an activist, of course, and she died just a couple of years ago. But she's well known in the community as a person who was empowering people with disabilities. So I've got this great grant to travel to Ireland to look at the National Disability Strategy, where they have quotas on employment, and bring the learnings back to Victoria for the State Disability Plan, which is about access to health, justice, education and housing and employment. But you know I'm being prevented by the federal government.
Why? How?
Well, because I'm on a small disability support pension.
It gets knocked off after how many weeks?
4 weeks. 28 days. I can only leave Australia for 28 days in any 1 year.
You people aren't allowed to travel.
Absolutely. Well, the thing is, my husband can travel. Noel can go,
but
he has to leave me behind.
You can't. That's right.
So it's going to. It takes me longer to recover from an overseas trip. It takes me longer to do the work that I'll need to do. I've been invited to then pop over to Manchester by Manchester University has asked me, because of the work I've done around breast screening for women with disabilities, come over and look at what we've done. Well, I can't do it because the government has decided that I'm a bludger. And can I tell you that Matthias Corby is called as bludgers.
Yeah, that's right.
And yet nobody's paying me.
Ably assisted by the Murdoch press.
Absolutely. And the thing is, though, they've stopped funding for advocacy.
Mm.
There's some great advocacy organisations here which empower people with intellectual disabilities. They've had their funding stopped. So next week I'm off to Canberra. Last week I was in Canberra as a finalist in the Leslie Hall Lifetime Achievement Awards.
Who's Leslie Hall?
Do you remember the Miss Australia Quests?
Yes. Of course I do as a young boy.
Absolutely, yeah. Where they would have all these attractive women who would be raising money for those poor, ugly people with disabilities.
That's right.
Well, Leslie Hall was the one who got it stopped by throwing herself on the stage and saying, stop this.
Yes.
She was an activist, a brilliant woman who had a brilliant mind, and she retired on the Friday as the chair of Australian Federation of Disability Organisation, died of the heart attack the following week. Now, this award is the Prime Minister's Award.
Mm-hmm.
It's been renamed in her honour, which is probably pretty good. Because
it is very good.
Being awarded something by the current Prime Minister would probably make me choke. So, yeah, so what do you do in these circumstances? Do you accept the reward graciously or do you do a Marlon Brando?
Well, you do a Marlon. Well, it's up to you. Yeah, it's your individual choice. But I just want to ask you some – obviously you're doing an extraordinary amount of things, but I want to ask you some things that people really may not understand because, you know, this spectre of polio, has it left you or – is it a continuing issue?
I have post-polio syndrome.
What's that?
Post-polio syndrome is means that I have increased paralysis. I've gone back into calipers. I now need crutches. I'm losing my voice. I have to rest for an hour a day and not talk, which is really hard. With my feet up, I have to do exercises for my throat. I have what they call polio asthma, so my breathing is now affected. My right leg, which is my good leg, we call it good leg and bad leg, is also becoming weaker. Mm. My arms are becoming weaker. So I have to do everything now. I've got to get everything done. I've got to work really hard, but I can't because if I had to leave police because I worked too hard. I couldn't even read for 2 years.
Right.
So police were excellent to me, by the way. They tried to keep me there. Mm-hmm. They gave me leave to try and recover
a bit. I thought they were going to put you in a cell.
Well, they did that too, but right. Yeah. But they allowed me to work from home. So, for all the bad things I say.
So it is a continuing issue. People think, absolutely. A lot of people think people with disability, the problems happen, you're born with it, you acquire it, it's over. But that's the beginning, isn't it?
It is. And it's a continual battle. And as we age, of course, all of us, we're all going to end up with a disability eventually. It is harder and it's not just me. People think it's just polio.
Mm.
We've got people with Down syndrome who are living longer. They get dementia. We've got people with cerebral palsy. And I actually suspect there's a similar late effects of cerebral palsy because a lot of my friends who've got cerebral palsy are having increased spasms, increased weakness as well. Mm. And I think that people don't understand that it's actually a continual battle to maintain who you are. But I think one of the other, we've got a couple of battles that we face. One is the assumption that if you grew up without a disability, you're more worthy than those who have a disability from birth. So if you acquire one later, it must be harder on you. Oh, well, you're a better person, so we better raise some money for you, especially if you're a sports star.
Obviously.
We'll raise money for you for your wheelchair and who have never been able to work because they've been excluded. They're suffering.
Not worth worrying
absolutely.
About.
Absolutely.
And that's the mentality. And the thing is, it's fostered by government. It's fostered by the corporate sector.
It is.
I mean, how many corporations make the changes to allow somebody with a disability? Because they're excellent workers.
Absolutely. Well, the evidence is clear that they don't take
workers.
Sick leave.
That's right.
They don't take sick leave. They're more loyal to their employer. Yeah. And Becky has done some work on this, and the evidence is quite clear, and yet they don't get the jobs. But they're really, really happy to have us as volunteers.
Oh, yes.
So in the health sector, I've been asked to write policies, and when I put my hand out for the money, they say, well, hang on, aren't you a volunteer? Yeah. I'm only a volunteer because nobody pays me. And when there's been volunteer positions, when they become paid positions, they go to somebody without a disability.
Now, on this very special day, what's your advice to people listening to the program?
Think about your own attitudes towards people with disabilities. Accept us as equal Australians. I proudly call myself an Australian with a disability. I'm not disabled. I'm only disabled by society's inability to provide me with the supports and services I need. So think about your own workplace. Think about your own social circle. So we cross all barriers. We're across all ethnicities, we're across all sexualities, we're across all socioeconomic boundaries. We're everywhere. We're 20% of the population.
Excuse me?
20% of the population.
20%?
Absolutely.
1 in 5?
Absolutely.
And you're living longer, aren't you?
Yeah, well, I'm planning to.
There's more of you, aren't there?
It's
like zombie.
The Bureau of Statistics say that we're actually decreasing, but they only use extrapolated data. They don't use real data. I don't get counted in the census.
Why not?
As a person with a disability.
Because there's no question.
There's two questions which we fought for years to get in, but it's about whether you need help.
Ah, right.
And it's really about, are you a good person who's caring for a person with a disability? So if you take the extrapolated data, there's 20% of us have a disability. And then if you look at the people according to the census, have primary caring role. That's 13.5%. Mm. So that's 33.5% of the population have a direct link to disability. Mm. And then you talk about all of our families and the service sector, people who work in the disability sector. Why the hell aren't we a bigger voting bloc?
Don't know.
It was only recently that we got on the COAG agenda.
That's right. Now, getting back to yourself, you've turned 60, I see.
Yeah.
So you got any plans for the immediate future and long-term future?
Yeah, I want to get a job. I want to get a
You
paid.
Want a real job? Yeah, paid job?
I want to be paid for the work I do.
I'm happy to be your agent.
Thank you.
And I'll take 0%.
Good.
Now, did you hear that? This is a very intelligent, capable, radical woman who needs a job.
I need a job as a radical woman, though. Yeah. I don't want to be sitting there doing nothing. No, I want to actually be out there and paid for the work I do.
Mm.
I want to keep working. Mm-hmm. 60, yeah, I imagined myself on the beach in Hawaii or something.
Yeah, it's a waste of time.
Absolutely.
Sand in your bottom, it's just not my idea of retirement. Yeah, good.
But I really am not very good at staying home, so that's not going to happen. Mm. So certainly need a job being radical. Mm-hmm. And I want to keep doing what I'm doing because there's an awful lot of people out there who don't have a voice.
No, you're quite right. Well, look, this has been a very special interview on a very special day with a very special person. And I wish you and your husband all the very best for the next 40 years.
Absolutely.
And I expect an invitation to your 100th birthday party. I'll be 103.
Excellent.
And I'm sure we could have a dance.
So, can I just say that I can't do what I do without the support of the people who allow me to get out there. So Noel's excellent, my family's excellent, and the disability community is excellent. And there's also a lot of good people in the mainstream community who get it.
Great. Well, thank you very much. We've been talking to Trish Maloney, but with a W.
That's it.
Look it up. She's on the internet. I know. I've been told all about her. Look it up if you want a good, radical, hard-working activist on your payroll, and that's the key, on your payroll, on your board, now's the time. You've heard it here on 3CR, Radical Australia. Thank you very much, Trish. Look after yourself. Look after that poor old husband of yours. He's going to need a lot of caring, I think.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That the dice are loaded, everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows that the boat is leaking. Everybody knows the captain lied. Everybody got this broken feeling, like their father or their dog just died. Everybody talking to their pockets. Everybody wants box and chocolates and the long stem rose. Everybody knows. Everybody knows that you love me, baby. Everybody knows that you really do.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.